All right, welcome everybody tonight. The title of class is On the Wings of Eagles. Hebrew is Al Kanfei Nesharim. Okay, so that's a famous statement from the Chumash which we're gonna learn. Okay, so that's in fact that's appropriate for coming up on the holiday of Shavuot and the Jews' 49-day trip to Mount Sinai. God says, I brought you on the wings of eagles. That's what we're gonna focus on tonight, which gets you A, the class we're gonna do, plus the introduction to Shavuot a little bit. Okay. Let's get on that. So, in a way, we're going to do that is going to take you to introduce you to, or may have heard. Anybody here heard of Outward Bound? Raise your hand if you heard what Outward Bound is. Okay, we got one, Scott Shapiro. Okay. All right. Well, there you go. You're going to learn something new, which is why you came. All right. So let's go to the let's do a share screen. This is basic, what we're sure. Here's what it is.
Here's a day to bring it like you've never brought it before. First of all, I would like to officially welcome you to Outward Bound.
Yeah!
Yeah!
Outward Bound is a character development school that uses high impact activities in a wilderness setting to teach human skills, leadership, communication, teamwork.
The courses are really hard.
If it's not hard, I'd say it's not Outward Bound.
I mean, the point is that you do things you don't even think are possible and you take on more responsibility along the way.
Shed a lot of tears, both laughing so hard and from facing things I've never faced before, and this is the best way I could have spent this summer.
And the more time you spend out of your comfort zone, the larger your comfort zone actually gets.
That's where confidence comes from.
The biggest thing is self-confidence and pride.
Going through an Outward Bound experience lets you understand that you really can accomplish anything.
It just gives you a whole new sense of life.
And it really makes you see your potential and what you're actually capable of.
I felt great, like I was on top of the world. I felt like shouting, like I accomplished something.
Look at that!
Students will say that more often than not, that if I can do this, I can do anything.
Because you can take confidence home. You don't know what you're gonna do with it, but whatever you choose to do with it, you're gonna do more.
See how much they grow, not only as a group, but as individuals, is phenomenal.
I'm super stoked to be here.
It's incredible.
This course will change you.
This place definitely changed my life.
This is exactly what I need right now.
Go on.
Out of each course. I think it is that the classroom, so to speak, that I get to work in.
The range and
the emphasis on compassion is really evident in the way people behave.
It's just being out on course and seeing like a rainbow or a sunset, or just feeling that, you know, sense of tranquility, you know, the quiet, and hearing the, you know, birds and animals around you. It just kind of brings a sense of peace.
Seeing what can change for folks in that short amount of time and the insight we get into ourselves and our lives.
I just love changing people's lives, bringing them out into the backcountry and going climbing and mountaineering and backpacking for 22 days at a time. Really seeing people change as far as taking them out of their comfort zones and sticking them into situations that they've never been in before.
I love Outward Bound.
Okay. You able to hear that, guys? Guys, you able to hear that? Yeah, good. Good. Excellent. All right. So what you saw from the video, what's the goal of Outward Bound? Character growth, okay, through what vehicle? I mean, growth. I mean, isn't any taking any class growth? Is there? So you're saying, well, first of all, growth is kind of a little bit. Let's be a little bit. Can we be a little more?
Character growth. Spending.
Yep.
Yeah, taking away the comforts of home and you're pushing yourself to survive.
Well, that's what. Yeah. So, okay. So let's develop it. That's basically what you guys said is the point. Just for Evan and Diane who are in Zoom land. Diane, if you could share, if you go, we won't mind your wet hair if you're willing to put your video on at some point tonight. It would be great to see your Shane upon him, as they say in Yiddish. All right.
You look great, Diane.
Very good. Such an affirming, you. Supportive camera here at MFAB. Okay. Why is overly comfortable living at home such an obstacle to growth? Or why are they taking these people... Why are they taking these people for 21 days and doing either mountain climbing or sailing or long backpacking? Why can't you grow at home?
Well, this is like a scenario you're not familiar with. So you can't, like, you have to come up with new, like, skills or ways of doing it.
Right, so you're forced to develop, either learn or develop or adapt new skill sets because these people are not professional mountain climbers. They're not, but their goal is not to make, this is not a backpacking school. This is not a sailing school. In other words, it was very clear from the videos that the goals of all these different things are instrumental. They're a platform for these growth. So they're Yaron pointed out, the goal is you're trying to build resiliency. So the way that you do it, the means of doing it is through having them, pack all their food and clothes for the next 5 days and go out into the outback and have to do these specific things. And because you're, what happens when you're, and if you're at home, why can't you build resiliency on your couch? Because you're not stretching at all. You that's literally the comfort zone. The couch is the comfort zone. You're in other words, you are not causing yourself to go at all out of your normal sphere of behavior. You're on the couch, you're watching Netflix, you might have a salty snack, there could be a carbonated beverage, possibly alcoholic, and you are watching 1 to 3 shows. And you feel very good about that because you deserve it. But you've done that before, and after those 3 shows, you might have some regret that why did I waste all that time? But you're not going to become a different you. You're the same person who just spent 3 hours watching something. So here, you're forcing new skills, which are challenging, physically demanding, emotionally demanding, uncomfortable, and that's it. So that's question 3. How does 24/7 training in extreme physical situations outside the home help us get past the psychological barrier to growth? Why don't we? There's another factor why we don't grow in our normal day-to-day life. And if it's, and therefore what? And when something is hard, what do we not do? We don't, whatever it is. If it is hard, we do not do it. I want to tell you a story. I was dealing with a person in the MJ community who I believe it would be very helpful for them to go to therapy. And they went once. And then week 2, they didn't go. I called them up. How's it going? I'm trying to do some encouragement. Well, Rabbi, I don't know. I'm not sure it's for me. Okay. Because the reality is, I need to explain to you that basically going to a therapy is going to be uncomfortable. There's lots of parts within you that don't want to go. It could bring out, it could be scary. You don't know what you're going to find when you start to lift up the hood.
and there are certain issues that you may not want to look at, and that's why you don't. That's why you don't want to show. So it's easier just to sit on the couch and hopefully that the problems will solve themselves, but they rarely do. So they're basically pushing, and you don't know with Outward Bound, you can't like suddenly like picking up an Uber in Sequoia National Park in the middle. No, that's not an option. You leave. You can't like Uber it back home. No, you are out in the wilderness. You with your staff, and that's it. So you're forced to come to grips with certain issues, and you have to and breaks is going to occur. I would say also, what does it happen? What element while the team is brought out? Why? Why should people grow connected to each other? Why? Right, the care and the gore. In other words, the whole group knows that if each person does not do their part of the job, they're going to starve or be endangered. Or they keep it on the edge of it's going to be a problem. Well, they're going to have to bring in the helicopters, okay? In other words, it becomes very obvious for every person that whatever gear and role and I don't really want to walk all the way up that. No, you're not having, there'll be no dinner and you will not be in a tent tonight. You got to, move. So that kind of pressure causes people to grow, work team skills, become collaborative, you feel more comfortable. Once they see they can do something, they say, well, maybe I can do something. So that's it. Yes, Eitan.
Well, when you are around other people, you have to draw those people to learn.
Right, you have a solidarity with your chaver. You do not want to let your team down and make them starve you don't want to be the one holding everybody back. So that's a tremendous pressure. So that it's well orchestrated to create in those 21 days major break. Now it's not, they have for people who have certain, they have a addictions component people, but that's not only there. They have Outward Bound programs for everybody, but just for middle school and high school and college and young adult. They have it for all kinds of people. Okay. Now, in what way is MG Fellowship Israel trip similar to the Outward Bound experience? How is going on that 7-day, 8-day trip to Israel? Some of you went with me last year and those who went years past. Is very similar in many ways to an Outward Bound experience. Well, what do you mean by taking out your comfort zone? What is the most key thing about your comfort zone?
You're unfamiliar with the environment you're going to. You're not fluent in the language.
You're not asked to speak Hebrew on the trip, though.
No, but you're in an unfamiliar environment.
What's unfamiliar about it? Not just that. I don't know if you guys noticed that, but basically, what the MG Fellowship trip basically asked you to the fellow to do is to essentially act as if they were a fully observant Jew for 7 complete days, which is not something which everybody is easy for everybody. I try to make it. I always ask, was this religiously challenging for you? I always find it's like, no. But I'm saying we're having minyan. Most of the people who have gone have not davened that much in a row. You know what I mean? They're having, you're eating kosher meals. I'm just saying each person, I'm just saying over the 15 years, different parts of it is a little bit, and being is also, and you're going to walking around Israel clearly as an observant Jew, which maybe somebody in New York, you're living as a New York Jew, don't have to necessarily be that. So you're being comfortable, you're put out of your comfort zone. You know what I mean? Now we're benching together, sometimes out loud in the restaurant, which you may not necessarily do when you're in a restaurant in Manhattan. I'm just saying you're so they're basically, that's really, and you're as a group. Everybody's on the bus, we're off the bus, some people quicker, some people slower. So Yes, Ethan. Sure. Yeah. Right.
We got up really early, like 6 a.m. for soccer, so it's on Araba. Beautiful. It was like a really like intense experience of hiking.
Well, I think who here went with us, or myself or Rabbi Avi, to the Kotel for the sunrise davening? Can we do that? Dr. Spiro. Okay, so that's something that most people are not going to do. Or I'm just saying that, and what we have seen over the years is that many people will continue once they feel like they feel confident that I can be a more observant Jew. It gives them a measure of confidence, like, you know, I can do this to a certain extent. For some people, there are people that was their first Shabbos and they kept on keeping Shabbos from that point. Not because we said anything. It was all an internal process. It's the best kind of thing. In other words, they felt that this was a good experience. I can do this. Now, it was helpful to have the group experience, to have the wonderful summertime in Jerusalem. I mean, I always like to say that our Shabbos experience, like Friday night, is basically what I would call Shabbos by Disney. You know, you're at the Kotel, you're overlooking the Western Wall. The sun is going down. The Kotel is now pink. And suddenly you see thousands of different kind of people. We have Haredim, we have Dati Lumi, we have Visitor, everybody together. You have the UN of humanity coming together at the Kotel Plaza. And you are there with your chevra for a week of a thing, and you're dining on the rooftop there, looking over the Kotel. And that's a highly curated experience. Your next Shabbos is not typically going to be that. You know, it might be slightly disappointing, but whatever. I'm just saying my point is that highly curated experience can be impactful, as you said, provide a measure of religious resiliency, religious confidence, a deeper understanding and appreciation. That really, if you want to understand what that was, the Israel trip on a meta level. But now, you know what I'm saying? Does that resonate to you as what you felt on the trip itself? But it wasn't so much to be physically demanding. It was very long and schleppy. We're going to actually try to tamper down a little bit because it was just a little bit too much squeeze into a day. But a lot of information, a lot of running around, also a lot of meeting of a lot of different kind of people. Right, you're learning Tanakh, where it actually occurred. These are big moments. We continue. Yes.
We're not really, I've started coming up stone a lot recently.
Good.
I read and fix it sometimes. But when I put this time, am I supposed to put a shirt on over that? I think when I put out the cylinder, it doesn't matter. I think I saw someone else do it. Just at this point, I'm required to put a shirt on.
If you're putting a talis katan, it's good to put it under shirt. You want it to be a primary garment. So if it's going to be on your skin, it might be basically a garment for sweat.
Well, I mean, the talis katan is a primary. Am I supposed to put another shirt over that one I got?
Yes.
Primary?
It should be.
But that doesn't mean it's on the outside?
No, I mean, it shouldn't be just used for, like, absorption of the sweat. Like, an undershirt you wear, which is absorption for sweat.
That's weird, because I just kind of think of it as, like, the whole point is to keep them out. Like,
no, I understand, but I'm just saying that it would be lacking the garment if it's just a tool of sweat absorption. Okay, then we digress. Yeah, you should wear a shirt, yeah. Okay, so the guy, okay, we got a little, okay, all right. Look at the quote there by Kurt Hahn. Kurt Hahn made a nice, this is the guy who developed developed Outward Bound. There's more to us than we know. If we can be made to see it, perhaps the rest of our lives will be unwilling to settle for less. That's very powerful. That's a very important point. That in other words, it's not only about confidence. Is that here's a question for the person to ask. He's saying that we're using a fraction of our potentiality. And if we're able to open the door to see our various capacities, there could be, you can live literally a different life. So having a growth opportunity to see new aspects and capacities could allow a person to live a life of not just quantitatively, but a life of a qualitatively of different kind. Okay, so let's continue going. All right, so let's go to Shmot. Let's have Diane, you want to read?
Sure, if you give us this verse, I will.
I'm going to do just that. Just checking. Where is it? Okay, now a second. I have to, not Windows, 1 second. Let me go here. Share screen. Thank you. Okay. Vakasha. This is coming up to, all right, read it out. Shmot, chapter 19. Yeah, read it out.
In the third month after the Israelites left Egypt, on the first of the months, they came to the desert of Sinai. They had departed from Rephidim and had arrived in the Sinai desert, camping in the wilderness. Israel camped opposite the mountain. Moses went up to God. God called to him from the mountain and said, "This is what you must say to the family of Jacob and tell the Israelites. You saw what I did in Egypt, carrying you on eagle's wings and bringing you to me. Now, if you obey me and keep my covenant, you shall be my special treasure among all nations, though all the world is mine. You will be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation to me. These are the words that you must relate to the Israelites." Moses came back and summoned the elders of the people, conveying to them all that God had said. All the people answered as one and said, "All that God has spoken, we will do."
So this is the Bris Sinai. This is the covenant at Sinai that God made to deal with the Jewish people. Now, we've actually discussed the covenant. We're not going to focus on that part tonight. We're going to focus on the, you saw what I did in Egypt and carrying you on eagle's wings and bringing you to me. I just want to ask you a simple question is, well, what does he mean by that? What does it mean that Hashem brought the Jewish people on the wings of eagles? So what was miraculous about that? The question is, what is the eagle? What is the metaphor? What does the eagle represent? Well, that's like America. We view that as why does the eagle represent freedom? What's the other quality?
Defies gravity, yeah.
Right. So a value as a bird is that it does not it can avoid any one of its predators. In other words, it is not likely going to be killed by another animal because it can outfly them.
I guess what I was saying is that it can fly over borders and boundaries that otherwise.
All right. So you're saying the Jewish people, Hashem caused the Jewish people to get to Sinai in a boundless manner, okay, in a freedom manner. You can also say the point is that also is very quickly. In other words, eagle goes very quick. To also, you can mention, as you mentioned about that they did not have any enemies. In other words, they were also protected. Hashem took them out in a protected manner. All these different possibilities the Mefarshim pick up. The Ralbag. All right. Diane, read the raw Bhagavad Gita.
You saw the great wonders that I did to Mitzrayim on account that you will know that I am Hashem and you will believe in me. Therefore, I've extracted you swiftly from your corrupt beliefs, and I've brought you to my service with amazing miracles, as if carried you on the wings of eagles who are incredible swift birds.
Okay, so what feature about the eagle is the Ralbag picking up on? He says, the main quality of the eagle is what? In his mind. They're very fast. They're not able to go quickly. Now, so what is it? Now he has a very interesting idea. What was the swift extraction? Is it that the fact that, in other words, if you traveled from Egypt to Sinai, would it just take 49 days or could it take even shorter? Way shorter. So it can't be that they got there like 25 minutes. It doesn't mean that they got to Egypt, to Mount Sinai, doesn't mean that. So it means not, so if it's not talking about a geographic swiftness, it means a different kind of swiftness. What is the swiftness the Ralbag is underscoring here?
Spiritual impurity, worldly strengths, and elevation, God being spiritual.
Correct. I mean, the Jews were fundamentally Egyptian, fully embraced their idolatrous and materialistic perspective. We just had last week's Parsha. It says, like the activities of the Egypt don't do. We're basically talking about a completely hedonistic sexuality. So Hashem is basically fast-forwarding, what we use nowadays in our book, a fast-tracking. He fast-tracked them out to make them as much as non-Egyptians, you know, instead of Egyptian wannabes, to make them as much Jewish as it could be till they got to Sinai, okay? Because you can't give the Torah to an Egyptian. Why not? I mean, is it just factually like an identity issue?
Insofar as someone who remains in Egypt.
Correct. In other words, it's not, in order you can be, in order being Egyptian does not mean that you are actually limited to being a citizen of Egypt. It means that you embody the belief and culture of Egypt. So your extraction from the culture of Egypt is very hard. I'll make you a very simple analogy just to appreciate how hard that is. Has anybody here lived in a foreign country for, let's say, a semester abroad? Has anybody done a semester abroad? Or been in a foreign country for at least a month? Yes. Yes, 1 month. Where have you been? You've been in many places. Okay, good. Let's go to China for 2 years. Let's talk about China. So when you landed in China, What about you did you feel very obvious about? Your Americanness radiates from every pore of your body. You are clearly not. Yes. So for you to transition from being a full-blooded, red-blooded American, as we like to say, to being a member of the community, to the Chinese society, that would be, how long would that take? How long would it take? It took you 2 years there for 2 years? How long did it take you felt that you were, or did you never feel that?
I studied Mandarin for 8 years and to actually feel comfortable there, I mean, it takes a lot of work.
Exactly. Okay, so just meditate upon that. Justin studied Mandarin Chinese, one of the hardest languages in the world, and spent 2 years in China and still felt fundamentally 100% American. Okay, translate that. The Jews have been in part of Egyptian culture for 210 years. How Egyptian are you? You're 100% Egyptian. That's how Egyptian you are, okay? Except that you have done the Bris Milah, you have done the Korban Pesach, you've done some define acts of being, at least in some sense, rejecting of that culture. But if your cultural intuitions is full on Egyptian, you're dressing like an Egyptian. The clothes you took out of Egypt were clearly Egyptian. Not only, you know, you're clearly walking like an Egyptian. Okay, I had to throw that joke. So the point is that what the Ralbag saying, he can't untangle them from all the cultural trappings and elements. Let's say, for example, let's talk about food. Okay, we're Americans. We like the classic American diet. We like pizza. We like burgers with the fries. Like that. Right. So. That we like the American fare. So you're always going to like that. That's not what it means by taking you on wings of eagles. He says at least Hashem in 49 days was able to get them out of at least their corrupt beliefs. At least that part. You can't. Once you're an immigrant, you're always an immigrant. Remember, this is a new way to look at the Jewish people. The Jews who stepped by Sinai were 600,000 immigrants. Very much Egyptian. What the Ralbag is saying, Hashem is saying to Moshe, you tell the Jewish people, I took you out of Egypt because I basically at least took out you from their beliefs, their false beliefs about, you know, about the divinity of the Nile, the divinity of the Paro, their entire, and begin to the journey to become internally a Jew. Now, culturally, in every other way, the food they liked, Egyptian. Now, could very well be why their food got shifted to Amman. I'm just thinking this out loud with you right now. It was basically trying to change some of the cultural norms to really leave as much as possible culturally from Egypt. Their dress was Egyptian. Their sensibilities are Egyptian. Again. Yeah, and they look back, and we were in Egypt, we were sitting there, al sir ha-basar, by the pot of flesh, or what we call in America, the all-you-can-eat buffet. Who doesn't like the all-you-can-eat buffet? Now, I know. Now, again, is that an accurate recollection? Did I experience, was that a norm? Was that an occasional thing? But when, you know, in life, when we look back at certain things, we do an editing job on the situation. So that which we wanted to highlight being a, you know, they took that scene, right. Expanded it and extended it and added, they embellished upon that. I don't think that.
I only brought it up to show that there were things that were given up that they had to be brought out. Right. They were, in that sense, too, like they, much more to your point, like they were culturally Egyptian, but there were also trappings, material comforts of being in Egypt they were taken away from. But
correct. Yeah. This was super hard. Okay. So question six, what is the true challenge of getting out of Egypt to Israel or to Sinai? So it just said, is it the work of just getting to a physical nation, or is it a deeper challenge? So we're talking about you're struggling with issues of identity and worldview. In other words, to put it succinctly, this is not my own line, it is easy to take the Jew out of Egypt, but it's hard to take the Egyptian out of the Jew. Very hard. I'm just trying to give you, and I think Justin's example is a good one. You just did the reverse. Be an immigrant. It is super hard. What feature of the eagle's flight does the Ralbag highlight in this commentary? How can the spiritual journey to be sped up? So that's a good question. How did Hashem speed it up? Did he suddenly give them the red pill and suddenly they said, oh, we're no longer Egyptian-minded Jews? What did they do? How did he do it?
Jennifer Wilcobb?
Say it again?
Jennifer Wilcobb. She does like book marketing.
Evan, I lost it. I guess he's not on. He's not. I'm going to mute him. I think he's not talking on me. Okay. He's not right. If you're watching from home and you're and the video's off, you're okay. It's a challenge to be fully engaged. Inhabit the class. Okay, so So I'm going to give you a hint. There are certain seminal events. Number one is the Makot. That obviously is the game changer number one. That shows you that the fantasy of Paro's power is a complete fraud. Plagues, the Makot, the call in Hebrew, the Esther Makot, the 10 plagues. Okay. Yeah. So they got, cause they got beat. Korban Pesach. How was that part of the speeding up fast tracking process? Yeah. But it's more than that. But were they just passive participants? Yeah, so that's basically the best way to see what that is. You know what Korban Pesach is? That is a dramatic act of conversion. That was, in fact, Chazal view that because part of what I think there are actually one step that every convert cannot do until there's a temple, which is a korban. According to many things, their korban of being a convert, in other words, the Jews are the model of conversion. So they did Brit Milah in Egypt, and that's step one. Step two, they gave a korban. That's the Korban Pesach. Step three, they went to the mikveh at Mount Sinai, and then there was the last thing is the Kabbalat HaMilk, Naaseh V'Nishma, which they did on when they heard the next day after the Ten Commandments. So giving the Korban Pesach is, do you understand how hard that is? You understand. You are going to publicly destroy the God of Egypt in front of their faces, roast it all in the afternoon, and eat it with your family. You have to be very convinced that this is the path of life you want, because that is massive. That's a massive rejection. So that was an outward bound experience in one afternoon. If you can do that, and that's why the Medrash says that many Jews couldn't do that, because that was a step too far. Yom Suf, the splitting of the Red Sea, how did that speed up their spiritual journey? So also, but did it just open? Did it split automatically? What's the famous measures that you guys have sure heard of? Naksha ben Amidav. He didn't split till he jumped in, which means that they had to take an activist position. And also, they had to be nervous. Like maybe you're going to go into this sea, but maybe it's going to close on you. So you have to have pretty a high level of conviction that Moshe is receiving a prophecy from God. Versus that you're going to die based upon the thoughts of a madman. You got to be very confident about that. Your life is on the line. And then the Jews have manna. They run out of food. They get man. They see man is being developed. It's delivered to them every day. It shows up outside every day. So these are situations that Hashem is forcing them. And also, but was man easy for them to deal with? Right, so you don't know if it's going to come back, and also it's the same food. So what is, in fact, when they complain about the man, what do they reference back about the food culture of Egypt? What feature about the food culture of Egypt do they bring up? You already mentioned some of it. The meat, we had fish for free. Notice the free, everybody likes the free food. Who does not like free food? The Kiddush emotion started back in antiquity. We had vegetables, we had fruits, we know what they had. We had a salad bar, we had katsu, we had fish, we had meat. In other words, they loved the variety of the abundant diet of eating at the table of the empire. Egypt was the most powerful empire. So even though that they're the lowest on the thing, so they're working for a guy. They threw him a couple bones. I mean, I'm sure they're not eating prime rib every day. But the point is that it was a wealthy enough society that they got to take and partake of some of the highlights of Egyptian life. First of all, they didn't take away their money. So Jews, if they had wealth, they could have bought delicious food. So when they had them on, this stuff sucks. Same food, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Terrible. It's nutritious. Yeah, but so is tofu. I don't want to eat it three times a day. Brutal. So Hashem put him on a food program. Anybody been on a food program? Yeah, it sucks because immediately you have the diet and you have the diet rebellion. But there's no options because you're out in the wilderness. It's not like Uber Eats that. We're in near Har Sinai. You guys want a pizza? Onion, a couple onion slices? Beep, 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 beep. No, not an option. It's mine for breakfast, mine for lunch, mine for dinner. Rough. Super rough. So this is basically a boot camp. So that's what it means. He didn't. Hashem does not change your mind. He's number 10. We learned from Rabbi Menachem Livdek both at MG and on location Israel. How did the learning about the battle of David and Goliath at Emek Ha'aleh add wings of eagles to our learning? What kind of learning? They were in other words, we're learning a chumash right now. We are currently on the 11th floor of 131 West 86th Street. We're learning the 19th chapter of the book of Shmos. Very nice. All of us, we're learning the story of David at the place it happened. We look down into the ravine and we literally can visualize little David going to fight big Goliath. How is that a wings of eagle experience? Makes it real. You could talk about rock climbing, but it ain't nothing till you are schlepping your body up the side of the mountain. You can talk about the learning, but then there's in doing learning in experience. 11, all of us finally remember the pre-COVID senior fellowship days and levels crowded around the conference table. Why does the class give more growth than the Zoom only classes? In other words, if you contrast, if we have a class, like I have a class on Tuesday night, Zoom only, versus Wednesday night when you're in person. What's the difference? What's the difference between Zoom classes and live classes? I'm gonna ask the people at Diane and who we got and Evan. What's the between being in person in class versus a Zoom class? What do you guys say?
I mean, the experience is different. It's when you're seeing the people, you're not. But from the standpoint of what you were saying before, I don't know. I'd say it's a different experience. Same story of like trying to change while being on your couch versus climbing a rock, climbing a mountain.
Correct. The point is that a class in person is a kind of immersive experience. You feel and sense your classmates' body language, what they're saying. You're listening to their voice. It's a different dynamic. You had a certain analogy you want to say, Yaron?
Obviously,
because
like
you
know,
it's
the Jews together discussing Torah, the Shekhinah.
Like, yes, the Shekhinah showed up on them. So I was, and Yaron want to say perhaps less so with Zoom. I would agree with that because he's recording Pirkei Avos. When 10 Jews come together to learn Torah, the Shekhinah is showed upon them, dwells upon them. I think the point is because what does it mean that the Shekhinah? It means that the reality of Hashem becomes evident to the people. When you have 10 people around a table, what you really have created is a symposium, a sharing of ideas, clarifying ideas, and a new insight will generally be born. Less, you don't have that same dynamic if you're all on Zoom. But Zoom is better than nothing. Let's reiterate that. All right, 12, our last thing of tonight. Jane MGE or Davin's at home every Shabbos. As meaningful as this is, her davening seems to lack the same inspiration and impact as she could attend services at MG on Shabbos morning. How does being at MG add eagle's wings to her prayer experience?
Yeah. Doing it by yourself. I mean, I have to say that Hashem didn't design us to be doing everything alone, and I feel like we can feel when other people are doing everything. I don't know. I mean, but like, I would almost say that that's almost just like part of human nature that we feel like the companionship makes it elevates us.
So, because the answer is there's a lot. when you're davening in a shul or, you know, an MG experience, can I deconstruct how many different things are really happening? Okay. A lot is going on. You know, okay, so let's say Jane is in her living room. How is she dressed? Casually, likely. There might be some pajamas, okay? Right. So already her demeanor is, so if the Amidah is standing in front of the Creator, it's hard to feel, number one. Not impossible, harder. A. B. When you come into a shul situation, first of all, it's a synagogue that already is designed to be what they call a Migdash Mod, a mini temple. So it adds a level of aura. It starts to sharpen the focus. Like this is designed to be much more present and mindful about having a Hashem experience. Point two. Three, even if you're, here's the thing. When you're davening the Amidah, which is completely silent, and you're in a room with people davening the Amidah, does that feel the same as being alone in your room, or feels different? They're not communicating to you. How does it feel?
Well,
you have an Am Yisrael experience.
Yeah, Am Yisrael.
You're feeling your sense of at least communal. Well, I want to tell you one thing. I think if I could distill, at least from my perspective, I think it has a subjective quality. So when I went, I don't remember when it was, the last time I went with the MG Ears to the, I think pre-COVID, we went to the Kotel and we davened the sunrise Amidah. So sunrise, well, I don't know, was like, I don't know, 5:50, something brutal. And everybody's diving, you know, and the whole place is a cacophonous. Y'all dive in the Kotel. It's a madhouse. I don't like diving in the Kotel in general because it's so distracting. It's like it's fine. It's hard for me to focus. It induces a level of ADHD. Like, you know, something like, you know, I need medication at that point. So, but the davening for the sunrise, the davening was called davening for Sikhan, davening at Hani Tzachama at sunrise. So when it hits that number time at 5:50, we hit the sunrise. There's about 1,000 people there. It's at 5:50 in the morning. And a complete quiet descends on the entire plaza. Everybody's davening the Amidah. Now we have Ashkenaz and we have Sephardim, we have Nusra, we have all different kinds of, you know, slightly different variations, and they're completely immersed. And there's a special moment about that. And then you just hear the I guess Scott. There's a special moment of special moment that sort of descends about here is the people sort of unified together to daven the Shemon Esrei at the exact same moment at the rise of sun, which is the idea why that's an excellent tefillah, is that I'm literally starting the service to Hashem at the beginning part of the first moment of the day. It shows the prioritization of my of where I view tefillah. That's why it's a very lofty to daven with a minyan at sunrise on a daily basis is the highest form of davening shacharit. So it's I can't really describe it any better than that. There's a sense of the solidarity. It was a cool thing, you know. And then you just have a place which is usually a cacophonous place suddenly became with an absolute silence. But not a perfect, like but basically of 1,000 people davening the Amidah at the same time, which is an impactful, which is it in and of itself is an inspirational moment there. You know what I mean? Which gives you what they call chizuk, gives you motivation and confidence. So that's why. So the Jews were going. They weren't going on this onward on this outward bound experience by themselves, but as a whole nation. Hashem sequenced the equivalent of the boating and the rock climbing and the hunting and the this and the thatting through various trying circumstances, make certain kind of breakthroughs on their life. And that's what he meant. And therefore, he was able to distill or to drain away a great measure of their Egyptianness, that they were able to make a legitimate, full-hearted acceptance of the Torah of Naaseh ben Ishmael. That was really what the deal is. And that really is, that's what now, that really connects to the Sefiras HaOmer, is that, you know, classic question, why are we, when you are going, looking forward to going to a glorious vacation, you count down 10 days to the vacation, 9 days to the vacation, here we're counting up. Because this is more like a health and wellness program. Day one of the program, yes. Day two, all right. Day three, it's viewed as a building up and trying to grow stronger. So basically our thought to be as we are approaching, coming closer to Shavuos is to think about how we can grow and use this Shavuos as a moment of inflections to strengthen our Torah muscles and become, to realize that we are capable of so much more than we are really touching right now. We have power and capacity and confidence that we have not yet reserved, that we have not even touched. And Hashem pushed them. And how do they like being pushed? They did not like it at all. Did they complain? They complained plenty. Fetching, crying, screaming, yelling. Pushed them to the edge. It was basically like a kind of a boot camp. But it had to happen in order to be able to be qualified, to be able to be eligible, if you will, to receive the Torah. And that's what we try to do every year. That's why we have Shavuos every year, to try to use that to bring that to mind, at least on our own level, in our own perspective. So that's something to think about as we walk towards Shavuos, something to think about in our own lives and apply that principle as we can, how we can push ourselves in a way that is, which is challenging, but not, which is, you know, push, not rip. You want to push the muscles. You want to rip the muscles. So that's that sweet spot. You got to figure that out. So always a pleasure to learn with you guys. Any questions? Okay. All right, guys. Rabbi, we did a little. I yield to you 6 additional minutes until Rabbi Wiles will have Tanya. It'll probably be more than 6 minutes, but at least, there's no crime in going ending early, is there? I don't think so. If you make the point, that's it. Get off the stage. That's it.
Thank you, Rabbi.
You got it. No ending in early. You're right. All right, guys. Have a great night. Good to see you guys. Be well. Thank you. Thank you.